I know you were all enthralled the last 2 weeks watching those conventions, right?
Yeah.
They're great here for ensemble. I watched them both of them, one of the puppets. Matter of fact, I take a walk in my neighborhood in the evening. My wife gets tired of me after a while and puts me outside. And I listen to it on my cell phone, walking the neighborhood. How many of them, excuse me, because I go, I think my neighbors think that I'm coming in more than that, but I have to. It's a fun adventure. This is the best week in America. Anybody know why? What started this week? And it's not the convention.
What?
Oh, that's a wonderful thing, but I was talking about the start of the NFL season. I know that's very, what we were saying was very kind of brief, intellectual and important, but where I come from, the NFL is more fun, so it is. NFL season starts this week. I'm all excited. I am an enormous Washington Redskins football fan.
Hey,
I'm sorry. Yeah, it's been kind of like a tough generation. The last time we won a Super Bowl, my daughter, who is now in college, was not yet born. So then, I don't even call it a dry spell. They turn it off the water. Hey. Hope springs eternal. And I, about 15 years ago, subscribed to DirecTV because you cannot get football games from Washington, D.C. here. You would get this rabbit ears, I thought. You'll have to do it by satellite. So I paid an enormous amount of money to watch very bad football. But my daughters are both Giant fans. They are in seventh heaven after they won the Super Bowl. They even come to the camp here, SUNY Albany, which we're very proud of. My wife likes the guests. She's from Long Island. She's a huge Yankee fan. That usually goes to being a Giant fan. My wife is like watching a baseball game with Babe Ruth or Phil Rizzuto or some famous commentator, because she will tell you everything that ever happened about the Yankees before the commentators even say it. She's an enormous fan, and she's a brilliant accountant. So stats are her thing, baby. I, on the other hand, have trouble following it, but she loves it. I am the only Washington Nationals fan in America, but I like them too. Why, as a kid from upstate New York, a Washington fan, I actually grew up in Washington, D.C. as a kid while my father went to law school and lived in an apartment complex with a lot of the Redskin players. And as a result of that, I'm a very loyal guy. So even though we really stink, I still love them. But anyway, enough about you. I hope all of you had a great weekend. This is going to be a fun, fun class. Please do not forget to sign the attendance sheets and get past prayer. We're going to go through, as we do, our lecture, and then we're going to do a case, which will be a load of fun. It's probably the most important case in American history. It's the case where all jurisprudential law, case law, started. Barbary versus Madison. It's a great case. You'll love it. We'll act it out and talk about it. Okay. Let's talk about tonight's class. By the way, some administration before we start. All the slides will be up the week before. I know some of you had some problems downloading this week's slides. I am sorry. That was my boo-boo. I loaded it up as class 02. The website recognizes it as class TWO. So if you don't type it in right, it doesn't load right. I made that correction after some of you were kind enough to inform me you couldn't download it. It was there. We corrected it last night, and hopefully everybody got it. From now on, everything will be up there ahead of time. The lectures are also going to be up there. Obviously, they can't be up there ahead of time because we don't have a time machine and we record them live. So you're going to have that up next week. How was your week? You have a good one? We miss you. Thank you for sitting up front. I pick on poor Helen, I know. But anyway, this class is about the law. Today's class is about the history of the law, and it's a fun story. In order to know where you're going, you need to know where you've been. In order to know property law, you need to know the law, because the two of them, remember, grew up together. They're interrelated. What did we talk about the last time? Class administration. Remember, hop on that website. It's a treasure trove. In addition to having the lectures, the PowerPoint slides, it also has the biography. We're going to add a page for cases that we do, so you know, you'll have to keep them in your backpack to download them. Additionally, it also has outside readings. Okay, we'll talk about that in a minute. Last week, we defined what the law is. Law is rules by which civilization is ordered. Simple as that. It's the rule book for society. Okay? We talked about the order of laws. Starts on top of the Constitution, then it goes to statutes, regulations, and executive orders. You ask, where is case law? Case law interprets it. So it's kind of like that sweeper in soccer. It's all over the field. Case law deals with the Constitution, deals with statutes, deals with regulations, and executive orders. Okay? Remember, our government here in the United States is a representative federal republic. It's bifurcated. You have the federal government, you have the state government. Okay? Both have constitutions, and both have sovereignty vested in the people. It's a unique concept. It was never done before in human history, and I'm sad to say has seldom been copied since. The fact that the people run the government, particularly when it's working right, is what is important about our governmental structure. You need to understand that to understand the law. That's the way it's set up. Okay. Tonight, we're going to talk about the importance of property. We're going to talk about the evolution of property rights, how they're intertwined. We're going to talk about the founders' views of property. We're going to talk a little bit about English legal history. Once again, you need to know how we got here. And you're going to talk about Blackstone. He wrote the Bible on the law. For 150 years, everybody followed everything he said. Law's kind of gotten beyond him now. But he's a great place to start. Okay. Before we begin, I do this over here. There are two ways you enjoy this class. And I hope you all enjoy it. I enjoy your company. I love meeting you. There's two ways to enjoy it. You can either be a submariner or a sailboat passenger. Are you a submarine student or are you a sailboat student? Two ways to do it. What are the differences? The differences are up to you. A sailboat enjoys the sunshine, cruises leisurely on a calm sea, just hangs out and listens to what's happening. Sailboat students certainly can get an A. They kind of just like pick a can and absorb what happens. They're there, they come to class, they enjoy the party, enjoy the day. What about a submarine student know?
What do they do?
Ah, they're the true explorers. They delve into the subject matter.
They read everything that's on the website. They go to the library and look up additional information.
They're the kids that get beaten up on the playground when you want to marry now that you're older. They're the ones who go in and are thirsty for information. The finest naval personnel are the submariners.
To wear those dolphins on your lapel means you're the best and the brightest.
You want to delve into the ocean and learn everything that's there, not just cruise on by and listen to the tubes.
Okay. Sailboat. Submarine. The choice is yours. The class is set up for both of you.
If you want to be a fellow student, come to class, listen to what we have to say, hang out with your friends, and just enjoy the law. If you want to be a submarine student, like me, you hop on that website, you read the outside, and you can go into the additional information. I will work with you both, and I want you both to have a great time.
Okay. This is a class on property.
It's my favorite area of law because, in my view,
and I have very boring, very lengthy discussions with my dad, who's also a lawyer, about what's the most important area of the law. I know we both have to get out there.
But I tell him it's property law because the law evolved with property to protect our property. Everything you value in life outside of your human relationships. It's property. The car you own, the house you live in, the money in your bank account,
your puppy. Those are all property. And the law protects your rights in it.
It's the basis of all law. I argue that the law was created to protect those property rights. That's what it's there for. My dad thinks contracts. And he's got a point. And yes, I have done a lot of contract law. But property's much more fun.
It really is, and we'll show you why. Let's see what some of our founders, some of the brightest legal minds ever, talked about. William Blackstone. We'll listen about him in a minute. He was probably the most prominent lawyer in all of the 19th century. Okay? He started writing in the 17th century. Okay? Or in the 18th century. So great, moreover, is the regard for the law of private property that it will not authorize the least violation of it. No, not even for the general good of the community. What does that mean? Private property rights are sacred. We're not going to violate them even for the benefit of the entire whole community. Your right to property is paramount. It's the basis of freedom. It's the basis of liberty. And speaking of freedom and liberty, the guy who wrote the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, said the purpose of government is to declare and enforce only our natural rights and duties and to take none of them from us, including the right to own, use, and enjoy one's private property. You will learn there are three basic rights: life, liberty, and property. Pursuit of Happiness, we'll talk about this, encapsulated that. It's an acronym for that. But those three rights are the basis of our freedom. Property is one of them. Here's John Locke. The preservation of property is the reason for which men enter into society and government. He said the whole reason we have a government is to protect our property. That's the reason we have a government. Why do we form government? Because we want to protect our property. One of the greatest legal minds ever, and the person who's more than anybody responsible for the foundation of the United States, we'll get to that tomorrow. Next slide. James Madison, the author of the Constitution of the United States, the author of the Federalist Papers, I misspelled four, but I'm sorry. Government is instituted to protect property, this being the end of government. This is the guy that wrote our Constitution. Now, this summer, I had a delightful little trip. I don't need to get out more, but I decided I was going to take my family, my two daughters, to Mount Hillier. Not the capital of Vermont, but the home of James Madison. It was there that he wrote and he studied the Constitution of the United States. He took and researched, he had a 10,000 volume library.
I can't even imagine where he could put it if the house wasn't that big.
He must have let people borrow and take it back.
Okay. He wrote the Constitution, studied and researched it.
He said the very basis for government is to protect our property rights. John Adams, incredible guy. We'll talk to him about him when we do our very first class. John Adams was second president. He was also the defender. People, the British soldiers who shot the public in the Boston Massacre because he thought everybody deserved defense. Property is surely a right of mankind as real as liberty. See a theme? See it? You want to protect liberty? You protect property. New York's John Jay, first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. It's the undoubted right and inalienable privilege not to be divested or interrupted in your use of property. Again, I know this sounds redundant. See a theme? Founders believe in this. Patterson, Wilson, who's probably one of the most prominent people in the signer of the Declaration of Independence. He was an outspoken delegate in the Constitutional Convention. This guy, outside of Madison, was more important for shaping our government than anybody else, and spoke more than Madison. Look at what he says. The possession or the recovery of those rights for property is why government exists. Okay. You get the point. Property equals liberty. You want to control your property, that's freedom. And let me tell you, the first postulate we're going to talk about when we're going to be explained next time. Property is God's name. Property is a collection of rights. Because it's not the item itself that's valuable. It's your ability to control it. Your ability to exclude others, to use it, to transfer it, and to possess it. That's what's valuable. And if you control that property, you have liberty. How do you make sure you can control it? That, my good friends, is where the law comes in. Because government and the law is instituted to protect your rights. And property is a collection of rights. That's where we are. Okay. What's the law? Rules by which civilization is ordered. Where does law come from? All roads lead to Rome.
Anybody have a county in the Senate here? Raise your hand. Wait, you. Where are you? Irish and Italian are doing all this stuff.
At the end of the day, Rome was the place where law started. It was the first society that looked beyond themselves. Now, I had a young lady when I first was starting teaching that the dinosaurs roamed the earth. She was from Greece. And she took great exception to the fact that all laws started at Rome. For her, I don't want her to say it was Greece. There's reasons why it isn't Greece. But if any of you are of Greek descent, I'll accept that answer. We're all proud of where we come from. I wish I could say it came from Ireland, but guess what? It didn't. But it does go through England, which is kind of cool to tell us.
It started in Rome. Why?
Rome was the first civilization that wanted to order itself. Remember, law is the rules by which civilization is ordered.
And Rome was the first society
that said it's not going to end with one person. It's a society. It's a civilization. The Roman society looked beyond the lifetime of one human being.
For those of you I've had the delight with teaching corporations, you know that Rome started the corporation.
Why?
What does corpus mean? Anybody speak Latin?
Yeah.
Body! Corporation is a person under the law. And Rome started that concept because they wanted their businesses to go beyond the lifetime of an individual. All societies before that, if you had a business, it died with you. Property rights.
Rome said, no, let's set up this artificial person under the law and it can go on forever, just like Rome. It was the first society to embrace the idea of continuity, that Rome laws would allow the society to perpetuate beyond the lifetime of everybody forever. Theirs was the first civilization to openly recognize that the culture of Rome itself was greater than any one person, any one emperor. It went on and on and on. And indeed, it was the longest lasting government in world history, even today. Roman citizens themselves were well versed in the law. And to do that, you had to be literate. Rome pushed literacy because they wanted to impress the law on people. Like so many institutions that Rome developed, the law was a tool. It was a tool to keep their society ordered. When we think of Rome, we think of the legions, you know, the guys with the funny hats and the sticks that march up and down, funny uniforms. Those are the things you think of, right? Okay. We think of military. But Rome
like the United States today, was an amazing economic power. They wanted to trade with everybody. That was part of their charm. That's how they made it. They were a great empire, not just because of their army. Their army was just another tool in the toolbox. They were a great society because they were an economic power. They traded with everyone. And they used their army, not a very polite way, took over a lot of places.
But when they did, unlike previous societies, they didn't insist you speak their language or eat their food or do what they do, their funny dances or any of that stuff.
I don't know if they have so much sense of humor, so I don't know if they can.
But anyway,
what they did insist is you adopt their laws. You could turn around and still wear your funny hats. You could turn around and still pray to that God that you do. But you had to adopt their laws. That was it. Trade with us and adopt our laws. It's all good.
That's how they grew their empire. And it reached all over the known world as a result of that. The law was a tool to instill consumer and merchant confidence. Created that level playing field. It provided a consistent template. Remember one of the things you said about law, it's got to be consistent? It provided a consistent template for governance and for mercantilism. Okay? That law was the tool that made Rome the greatest society ever known. It was also the first society, its legal rules, to trifurcate, divide in three, the divisions of power within its governance.
It had an executive, the empire. It had a legislative, the Senate, and it had a judiciary.
Now, not quite as distinct as those in America today, but one of the things that American forefathers and our English ones before that, we'll get to that in a second, look back at Rome as a model. They used it as a template. In a lot of ways they made it better because Rome wasn't perfect, but they turned around and looked at this as a model. The Roman Senate started when the emperor turned around and picked the 100 most prominent families in all of Rome, the Citizen Advisory Council. It turned into a legislative body. And they ran the country pretty much. With the emperor being the executive, the person who executed the laws. 12 tablets came out, 12 tables. They were a legislative enactment, first law of Rome. They had a quasi-independent, not completely independent, judiciary appointed by the emperor, overseeing the laws of the legislature. Roman law, unlike our current law, was all code. What does that mean? When you codify something, it's statutory. It was written in a book. And the Roman code became the law and is still the basis of the law for most of Europe. It was statutory. And it was provided by the Roman Senate, interwoven with decrees from the emperor. One of the things that code recognized was what? We're all here for one reason.
What do you think that code recognized?
You got it!
There you go.
It recognized property rights. It was the first set of laws to recognize property.
Now, it didn't recognize properly on Saturday in the individual.
You didn't own that cow under all the law.
Not close. Your family did. It recognized familial rights in property. Not only personal property in the cow, but also real property.
I'm envious. I wish I was too. Envious. Like the great architecture for which it's known, Rome was known for the system of law that was timeless. It lasted throughout the ages, 1,000 years. But why is this important to property law? You need to know where you started. And it started in Rome. You want to know where you're going? You need to know where you've been. Our law, of course, comes from England. But guess what? English law comes from where?
Where are
you?
There you go.
Rome! You guys ever hear of King Arthur?
That handsome guy, I know that you probably can't see him because of the glare of the screen. King Arthur was a Roman centurion. He was a Roman soldier. He was devoted to Roman law. He became king of Britain because when the Roman Empire fell, he kept it going in England. And the number one thing that kept it going was the British people's devotion and respect for the law. It keeps them orderly. It keeps people respected. It keeps our rights. What is he known for? Legal concepts, equality, rule of law, freedom. You know that round table thing going on? Military strength. That military strength was not to conquer other people. It was to protect the law and to protect your rights. Like many colonies, because England was a colony of Rome, it adopted their laws. But guess what? Remember the Roman soldiers come in conquering and say, we make our law, we're good. Well, they did that in England. The problem was, this is back before high speed rail or Southwest Airlines. So it was pretty far, far away, wasn't it? So the Roman Empire, which was thousands of miles away, wasn't really paying real close attention to exactly what's going on. So even though the code per se was not enforced, the concept of respect for the law was. Right? And it had value in the English people. Our law comes from Rome. Our law comes from England.
It goes from Rome to England.
Who's there? 1, 2, 3. Kind of like a great double play pattern. We have in the outside readings, for those of you who wish to become submarine students, a great professor by the name of Friedman. Wrote the history of the American law. It's on our selected readings if you want to download it. I know you're excited about it. But he talks about that nexus between Rome, England to America. He says that the American English-speaking peoples have that connection, that they're today. But all of our property rights, you really want to focus on, I know they start in Rome, but you can trace them down to one document. And what's that document? It's the greatest document outside of the Constitution and the Declaration. It's that third part. Anybody know what it is? Matter of fact, it's called Great Mystery. Anybody? Magna! Wonderful. What's your name?
Jenny.
Jenny, way to go. Magna Carta means Great Charter. It was originally called the Charter of Liberties. And it is the document on which all of our others were founded. And guess what? It talks about property rights. That's where it begins today. Okay? The story of the Magna Carta is a good story worth listening to. All begins in 1215, an awesome year. An important year in history for not only the Magna Carta, but also the Fourth Lateran Council. We'll get to that in a minute. Anybody know what a Lateran Council is? Anybody? Nobody? Yes. Very good. What's your name?
William.
William? A+.
That's hard.
Good for you.
The Fourth Lateran Council was one of the most important events in law, not just in religion. One of the things he did away with was trial by combat, trial by an ordeal. Anybody know what trial by ordeal is? To figure out whether you were guilty, they would throw you in the river, tied to a chair. If you came up and breathed, you were guilty. If you died, you were innocent. So was that for you. Not a real great way to conduct the jurisprudence. But there was an alternative. You could also do trial by combat. That means a little guy like me would take my sword and have to fight the biggest, meanest, toughest guy around. Kind of like being at Lawrence Taylor, not going to work. Matter of fact, I might try to trial by ordeal before I try maybe somewhere to be strong, to get to breathe. The Lateran Council said that's not a great way to conduct justice. Where does the word justice come from? No, it's Latin. Just comes from the law. The concept of the law protects our justice. Okay? Words have meaning, my friends. Okay. 1215. 800 years from the time of Rome. 800 years from the time of today. Almost 800 years exactly, number three. Yeah. 1215 was a very tumultuous time. Country really wasn't doing well. You have knights, you have swords, you have kings. England, how did it get there? Remember we talked, England as a nation, not just as the English people, but as a nation really formed under Arthur. Around 410 AD at the time of the collapse of the Roman Empire. After he died, a group of Vikings, known as the Saxons, came in and took control.
Ever hear of Anglo-Saxon? Well, the Saxons were the guys who basically took over the country. Saxons cultivated, even though they were Viking, cultivated that legal tradition because it made it easier to rule the country. And it rubbed off on them. 1066 happens. You got a king by the name of Harold. Anybody ever watch Monty Python? You see the Holy Grail? Anybody ever see it? Okay. You know, they say, you know, he's not a very good king. Well, Harold wasn't a very good king. I'm sure he's a nice guy, kind of small animals, but he wasn't a ruler. Country was kind of falling apart. And that tradition of laws began to devolve. So what happened? 1066. Enter William the Conqueror, also known as William the Bastard. But bastard is not a term meaning bad person. Anybody know what the legal term of bastard is? Exactly! Your father, and you have a father, but you're exactly right. Your father's not married to your mother. William had a rather prominent father. William's father was a local king in France. Back then there was a king of all of France, kind of ruled an area. Okay? But William's father kind of liked to play the field. And William's father was not married to William's mother. He had another family. Under French law, you had something known as primogeniture. That means the firstborn son gets all the property. Primogeniture means first in line, in generation. Okay? So the firstborn son got the entire estate. But you had to be not only the firstborn son, but your father had to be married to your mother, which William didn't have. So back then, you had one of three choices. You could either become a farmer, working for somebody else, not a very happy life, making turnips all day. You could become a priest, which in the year 1000, the Catholic Church had so many priests that they decided they couldn't get married anymore. First 1,000 years they could get married, second 1,000 years they couldn't. We'll see what happens with the third. But anyway. So that wasn't an option, particularly considering his lineage. The third thing is you could become a soldier. And there was a thing going on called the Crusades. William was a kick-ass soldier. He joined the Crusades, and baby, he made a difference. Commanded companies, rose through the ranks, and really showed great leadership skills. Comes back home, see them, because they were all back then. Comes back home, and he's sitting in a pub thinking about, what am I going to do for the rest of my life? Well, that priest thing doesn't sound that great. You know, farming's going to be pretty boring after, you know, conducting wars. Well, what am I going to do? So he talks to all his friends in a pub. He says, you know, we're a Viking heritage, this was. He says, what do Vikings do? Well, we get in a boat and we attack countries. Yeah, that's good. Across the ocean from the pub, and it says it's over. They look outside the window. England, that's where we'll attack. They couldn't attack their homeland because his father was the king and wouldn't get invited back to Thanksgiving dinner if he conducted war on his father. So he decided he was going to conduct a war against England and take over the country.
So he gets all his buddies who came home from the crusade, they all get in a bunch of boats, literally like, you know, a frat party, row across, sail across. He gets out of the boat. "I'm going to conquer England," and falls over a rock into the mud. Face all many. Gets up, literally, he gets up. Decides that he's going to take on Harold, but they don't know where Harold is. So they see a town off in the light, and they go out and ride their horses. And they go people to the town, and they say, "Can you tell me where Harold is?" Everybody raises his hand. And they go from town to town taking it over. Without any resistance, when I say they take it over, they basically say, "We're in the town, right?" They take over all these towns and are in search of Harold and his army. Why do they find Harold?
What happens when they find Harold? This frat party of a group. Hastings! They ride to Hastings! But what do they find with Harold? One of his buddies takes an arrow, shoots Harold in the eye. That's not really good for your health. Harold assumes room temperature. William declares himself the conqueror. Now, when you take over the country, you can call yourself the conqueror. He goes, "Not much of that bastard title. Not for me," goes to become William the Conqueror. If you talk to our friends in Britain, they'll call him William the First. William the Conqueror. He takes over England. William is a very good king. You know that leadership that helps propel him in the Crusades to be a good commander? It helps to propel him in peacetime to be an even bigger and better king. He turns around and brings feudalism to England. It was in France, he brings it over. Now most of us think of feudalism as slavery. Was it? A lot of people talk about it as if it was. It was not particularly good all the time. Now, from Russia, okay, you understand they took it into the 20th century, not so good. Okay? But back at the time that William brought it, it was actually a societal advancement, because those who, for whom you worked, owed you an oath. You turned around and gave an oath to your lord, and he would give you an oath back. It was a contract. For the first time, a landlord actually owed you a duty. Out of that concept of feudalism, which today we look upon like slavery, really came freedom. Why? Because those reciprocal oaths developed into the concept of rights. Because you owe me an oath, which you swore to God to protect me. I promised I would be a good farmer, work your soil hard. You promised to provide for my family. If you as a landowner didn't provide for my family, you were gone. The other lords would take you out because you violated your oath. What happened after William died? Feudalism and society became more advanced. this concept of rights started to develop. And it started from the king down. Now, Stephen was the nephew of William. Henry II was his descendant. Arguably, Henry II was the greatest king England ever had. He started juries. He stopped before the Fourth Lateran Council in England. They modeled themselves after him. He stopped trial by combat. He stopped trial by ordeal and started juries, whereby groups of your neighbors would determine your truth, would determine your guilt or innocence, would determine whether or not you have a right to property that somebody else would violate. What does the word jury mean? You may know. It does not mean you pull people in a box. That's what we think of today. But think of feudalism. All this stuff is connected, my friends. Jury means to take an oath. When you become a juror, you take an oath to listen to the evidence and render a fair verdict. There's a concept in the law known as a jurat. When you swear to something, there's a seal put to it known as a jurat. It comes from the word when you take an oath. And juries have been oath before God to try and weigh in his spirit. Henry II was the person who started that. He started the English common law. He appointed courts to make decisions on cases of controversy between his subjects. I walk up to you. What's your name? John? John, you think I took your cow? Our partners are next to each other. We both have cow. And you say, that's my cow. You know, that's, I know her. She's my cow. And she now in her herd. You took my cow. I said, no. I heard. You don't think that's my cow. You say, no, that's partly not malicious. That's an idiot. And that's my cow. There's proven, there's evidence. I don't think that. So you sue me. Okay? John, you're the judge. John comes, he lists all the evidence, he tells you how best to get it. He had a fence, there's an offense, the nail, the finger, you look at it, or the car, you look at it. And guess what? You say, come on, that is his time. Give it back. Okay? So I have to give you a cow back. What then is a decision of the court? That's where the common law started. And you write down that decision, Josh, and record it. Certain facts that existed the next time your cow gets stolen, the judge takes a look at that decision and says, yeah, well, no, this is what happens here. Maybe it's a little different, similar. We're going to follow what that judge said. That's precedent. And it started in England with Henry II. Now, Henry was a very strong king. His wife was from Aquitaine, which is in France. Any of you ever seen Snow White? Nursery rhymes and fairy tales were created as political humor. They were to tell stories. The evil queen in Snow White, you know, there on the wall,
was Eleanor, not Mary, and was the second wife. It was a political marriage,
similar to sometimes they happen today.
But one of the reasons why the British people created that fairy tale, Snow White, was because they didn't like Eleanor. She got mad at her husband. And unlike when Mrs. Farthing gets mad at me and threatens to kill me, she doesn't take an army and invade my country.
That's what Eleanor did.
Eleanor literally invaded England with her armies. They invaded parts of France that England had. It was, divorce is easier. I really came to do that. But, different men. So they turned around and created a fairy tale. She was the bad guy. And who do you think her son was?
Henry dies. And he leaves his throne to Richard. Richard is a young, handsome, strong young man. He goes off to the Crusades, almost the day he's made king. He is Prince Charming. Yes? That's right. Prince Charming is Richard the Lionheart. Again, when you're king, you can pretty much call yourself what you want. Lionheart. Conqueror.
Richard the Lionheart was Prince Charming. And he was a very lucky, able, talented guy. When he was king and in England, not the Crusades, everything was wonderful. Harvests were good. People were happy, lots of dancing going on, economy was falling. He goes on a crusade. Like 5 minutes after he goes on a crusade, he gets captured and held for ransom. When he's out of the country, you can't have him being king. He can't be ruling the country day to day. He's still the head of government, he's out of the country, but you have to have somebody else basically fill in. He had a not-so-smart younger brother. His name was John. Sorry, John, not you.
You guys ever see Robin Hood?
You know the Bungaroo King John? That's him.
Okay?
Remember how they wanted Richard the Lionheart to come back to good King Richard and Robin Hood? Please save us. John is destroying the country. That's Robin Hood. That's it. He leaves the country,
gets held for ransom. What does John have to do in order to pay the ransom? Raises taxes through the roof. Even back then, people weren't thrilled with high taxes. You're taking property out of my pocket. They didn't like John. They liked Richard. Bring back Richard. Bring back Richard. They were happy with him. Reign of John, he was also unlucky. Not only did he have to raise taxes on everybody, but the second Richard left town and he was in charge, harvest gold right down the tubes, prosperity disappears, pestilence, all kinds of horrible things happen. John's kind of a unlucky dude.
Okay?
Been waiting for Richard to return. Please bring back Richard. He pays the ransom. Richard comes back. Everybody rejoices. Richard is back. And Richard is one lucky son of a gun.
Harvest improves. Sunshine comes out.
Crops grow. People are happy. Dancing resumes.
Then what happens? He dies! Richard assumes room temperature. And we say, oh shit, John's back. John comes back. Now, you've got all of these landowners.
they don't want God back. We know about the divine right of kings. We know you come from God and all that. But you suck. What are we going to do? Well, just like in every other type of country and national situation, when you have a leader on the top, other leaders from other countries can take advantage of that. So when John comes back, all these other leaders and kings in France, where they have lots of property, start attacking them and taking stuff over, and John's like, oh my God, what do I do? He doesn't know what to do. He's frozen in fear, inept, corrupt. It's time for revolution. The landowners are desperately worried that you're going to have another situation where a William from France, and back then it was Philip of France. Okay? King Philip, who before this time was destitute. He didn't have a dime because he owed a lot of money to the Vatican bankers who were known as the Knights Templar. The Knights Templar were a sect of knights who were also priests. Back then, you could not lend money for a profit. It was against the church laws. So if you were a Christian, you were prohibited from charging interest for loans. An exception from that was if you were part of the church, because that interest was viewed as a donation to God. So the Knights Templar, who originally started as a security force for crusaders going to Jerusalem, decided they were going to get in the world of finance. And they became bankers par excellence. They loaned money to not only private businesses, but they also did it to royalty. And they became the greatest financial institution of the day. And the beautiful thing with the Knights Templar was, if you had a monastery in France, I could make a deposit at that monastery and then go to Spain to your other monastery and make a withdrawal. It was the first international banking system. And Philip and his family were into them big time. Back then, the Vatican was not in Rome. It was in Avignon, which is in France. It was under Philip's domain. He went to the Pope and said, you know what? I owe these templars a lot of money. I think they're really bad guys. I'm going to arrest them all. And I'll give you a part of the money. On Friday the 13th, and that's where this day comes from, he arrested all the Knights Templar and threw them in jail. Executed many of them, some of them escaped to Scotland. But why did he do this? He discharged all his debts. This means something in this legal discussion. It's not just a fun story. It then frees Philip to come after England. And they did. He started attacking all of the English land that John had neglected in France. Because back then, Henry, married to Eleanor, had built up a huge French empire. The landlords in England said, oh my God, Philip is going to come to England just like William and throw us all off our lands and give it to his buddies. We're a deep doo-doo unless we do something with this guy, John. Now, Back then, how did you raise an army?
The king just picked up the phone.
The way armies were raised is these landlords would go to the farmers and say, you want to work the field, but I need to send a boy to me to fight.
So exactly the landlords were able to raise the armies. They all raised armies.
But they all went after him and said, guess what? We're going to have to attack you because we know that you are going to cause us to lose our lands to France. Remember, mirror, mirror on the wall, we don't like the French, they're bad, okay? They didn't play well. They were afraid. So what happened? They all get together at a place called Runnymede. All of the landlords and King John and his inept forces. Now, King John was put on the throne, they thought, by God. So they really didn't want to kill him because they really don't want God to die. So they said, let's just get him to sign something giving us control of the country. Who here has seen The Godfather? Anybody? Raise your hand. What's the scene in The Godfather when he says either your brains or your signature on the contract? Okay? That's what they did at Runnymede. They surrounded him and handed him a contract and said, we really don't want to kill you because we don't want God getting mad at us. That's not a good thing. But we will if we have to, so sign it. Under a literally point of a sword, King John signed the Magna Carta, the Great Charter, the Charter of Liberties. He signed it and put his wax seal upon it. Notice in this picture, if you can see it, for those of you who see it, he's not looking like a happy hot camper. Okay? This is a landmark document. Incidentally, immediately after signing it, John said, I take it back. I didn't really sign it. They made me do it. I didn't like it. Then he died, so guess what? Didn't matter. We don't know how he died. He may have been helped. But at the end of the day, he died, and this charter survived. What did it do? It contains 63 clauses of liberty. And it's important because it contains property rights. It's the Charter of Liberties that is the first document in English jurisprudence that gives us rights. Now, it only gave rights to the landlords because those are the ones who pointed the sword at his head. But over time, the serfs who had an oath from the landlord realized, hey, these rights are going to come down to me too. And that document formed a basis for human rights for the first time. What did it say? It created a council to the king. That council we know today as Parliament. It created a legislative body in England, first time. It promised access to courts. Courts don't do you any good if you can't get to them. This said all freemen have access to courts and to a fair trial. It enumerated specific property rights and said to the king, we don't care that you are anointed by God. You have to protect these property rights. You can infringe upon them. What else did it do? It said it cannot impose by the crown unfair fines and punishments. We see a lot of these things in our Constitution, including that clause. It also gave certain powers to the Catholic Church. Why would it do that? Anybody know? Take it. Why would they give powers to the Catholic Church in that time? Nope. Well, think of start producing. First you get the money, then you get the... They have power. The Catholic Church is the other big institution on the block. This is a concept of separation of powers. If the king doesn't have that power, if we give it over to the church, it's a check on the king. It's a separation of powers. Pretty smart. Pretty smart. It was similar to what our forefathers did to separate the branches of government and to separate the states from the federal government. Said power consolidated in any one place isn't good. Let's separate it. That's why they did it. One thing it didn't do, sadly, was abolish involuntary servitude. You still were a servant. You still owed rights to that landlord. Why didn't it do that? The document was written by the landlord to control the servants. So those reciprocal oaths remained in place. It would be hundreds of years until the 1840s when that would be abolished in England and the 1860s in the United States. Okay. Those of you who are interested can go see the Magna Carta, one of the greatest documents in human history, in Washington, D.C. It's sitting right in the National Archives on loan, right there. Hard to read. I saw it this summer. Took my kids. They were so excited. They said, yeah, we're going to the beach. But it's also Latin, which I don't read all the much of. It's kind of faint, hard to read, but it's beautiful. You ought to see. Okay. Since the time of the Magna Carta, Anglo-American law has evolved into three sources. The Magna Carta started a constitution. It set up the government. It said, yes, we recognize you, King John, as enough as you are, but we're also going to separate the powers. We're going to give you a parliament, a legislative branch. We're going to talk about the judiciary and what we do. So the Magna Carta starts to set up the British government. It's their first document of a constitution. The British Constitution, unlike our Constitution, is a collection of items. Ours is one written document. But theirs is a collection of not only written documents like the Magna Carta, but also some case law. It also talked about statutes. It created the legislative body. And it talked about laws made by judges. It talked about the common law. And this, starting with Henry II, evolving through the Magna Carta with his son John, is where the common law, which descends to us, begins. Constitutions. They are the framework of government. The United States Constitution was written in one sitting, has been amended, in a constitution in Philadelphia. Magnificent piece of writing, mostly done by James Madison. Okay. It had to be ratified by the people, because under our legal system, flowing from those rights of the Magna Carta, we place sovereignty not in a king, not in the government, but in the people. So in order to ratify the Constitution, they brought it to conventions within the states for the people to ratify. First of its kind. Two-step dance, that Constitution thing we have. Adoption and ratification. Statutes. Parliament created the statutes. Prior to that time, even though they were a descendant of Rome, their laws were not codified. Rome had fallen apart. So they were basically edicts from kings, which changed from king to king, and common law, where judges had been courted. There was not a statutory body until the Magna Carta comes along. They create parliament. Parliament creates statutes. They became a statutory body, but after parliament came up. When the United States started, when we were a colonial power, we were of course governed by the laws of England because we were primarily English colonies. And even when we were, we ended up evolving into English colonies through either treaty or war. Okay? Our case law, our common law, was the law of England. That was the case even after our Constitution. We kept that law in place. Colonial courts followed British law. They followed the common law that was developed in Britain. The case for the cow, quiet in the United States as well. In England. Okay? British statutes, we didn't like them because when they passed them and affected the colonies, they weren't ones that we liked. Things like the Stamp Act, the Quartering Act. The Stamp Act was a tax. It said in order to buy paper or linen or high-end products, we had to get a tax stamp on it. Kind of like what we put on a cigarette or on a bottle of scotch today. That was done under British statutes by America. We didn't like that. The Quartering Act, Parliament said we could put troops in your house. We didn't like that so much. We put that in the Bill of Rights saying you can't do that. So Americans didn't like statutes. We loved the case law because it was a case-by-case basis. Was rules by which we could follow. Those statutes by that parliament 3,000 miles away across an ocean that nobody had ever visited anymore, we said, we don't know what's going on here in the United States. So early America was very statute averse, and our colonial legislatures only passed a few. Most of the law here was English. Common law. Basically, early Americans came here for property. Why? America had a lot of land. England had very little. Had a huge population and not a lot of spare room. So come to America. You can become a landowner rather than somebody working on somebody else's land. You can own it. So people came to the colonies to own property. People who came here, it was a selective process, wanted property rights. That's why they came here. It shifted property from the upper class to the lower classes, because anybody could get property in America. Okay? And property at that time, particularly real property, meant three things. It meant wealth, meant power, and it meant life.
If you wanted to live, you had to grow your food. Right? There weren't farmers that fed you. There weren't supermarkets. No shop right, no price shopper. Right? You wanted an apple, you had an apple tree. You want Cheerios? And you might have land to do that. You want to milk? You might have a cow. The cow has to be grass.
It meant wealth. It meant power. It meant life. And in America, we had so much land, much more land than people. The average bear could come over here. The second son, the third son, the fourth daughter could come over here and own land. You didn't have to be the number one guy. You could now be down the food chain and still get rich by owning land. You gotta take a chance. You gotta come to America. And that built a very free spirit. And people who believed in property rights, they came for property. So their law reflected it. Enter Mr. Blackstone. Now, for generations now, talking about the late 1700s, mid-1700s,
we have the common law of Henry II. What did he start? So for that period of time, that 600 years, you have a body of law that ended up in England. All those cow cases. Turned around and embarrassed me. I write something in the paper that wasn't true. I could bring all these actions in the court.
And these decisions were written down. But we didn't have the internet.
No, we didn't have the internet then. We didn't have any way to turn around and really get those decisions out there.
Enter Mr. Blackstone. He was an entrepreneur.
He was also a lawyer and a law professor. He turned around and went to all these courts around England and said, you need all your pieces. No, I got it. Wrote them all back. Went to every court in the country. He didn't want to get the dusty ones. He didn't. And he went to this tremendous book. Now, like William the Conqueror, he didn't just walk out through and stop. That's cool. Blackstone's commentaries on the law.
And it has basically narrowed down all case law in England.
And it becomes a great big hit. It's flying off the shelves.
Because everybody wants to know what that law is. They really care less about what it says
versus the fact that it says something that can go in here.
Because what is one of the most important parts of law you want?
It's this thing. He writes what they call the Bible on the law. He narrows down all these cases and writes commentaries
in multiple volumes. Published in 1765 to 1769,
those of you who want to have fun can turn around and download it off the internet, copyright as law.
It's on Google Books. I've actually used it. I know I need to get out of it.
But it's a fabulous book.
And becomes not only the basis for all court decisions in England, but in the United States.
In both, they all follow Blackstone.
it becomes the basis for the common law. It becomes the first recorder system. Right now, if you have a case in a state or federal court, and the judge writes a decision, that can get reported or published. They put it in a book. New York reports, report on New York cases. You have a Supreme Court, it's called miscellaneous. Appellate Division, okay, it's called AD Reporters. And Court of Appeals is New York Reporters. U.S. does the Supreme Court. We have Court of Appeals and Federal District Reporters. Blackstone was the earliest of these. And it was followed for about 150 years. Okay? Benchmark even today. If you want to look at the history of the law, even Supreme Court cases today cite Blackstone. American jurisprudence was heavy on case law. We were nervous on statutes. We did not have a high degree of comfort with big government. And statutes represented big government. We preferred case law, which was individual decisions, individual courts of elected judges who were our neighbors and friends who knew what we were doing. That's where American jurisprudence came out. They used Blackstone. Not only that, but when you had a jury trial on a major civil case for the cow or other money, or on a criminal case, it was your neighbors who decided that. You trusted your neighbors. So courts were much more powerful. In early American law, courts back in England were separated, and they were separated in the United States as well, into two types of courts. You have the court of law and the courts of equity. Anybody know what equity is? Correct. It has to do with the issue of fairness. Equity has all these maxims, they call them. Equity delights to do justice. Equity wants to deliver fairness. When you have a case involving money, that is a case at law. When you have a case involving fairness, that is a case of equity. I'll give an example. Remember the case on a cow? If you sued me for the value of investing, saying investing was worth $100, give me $100, that's a case of law. If you sued me for investing yourself, saying, Judge, I want that cow out, I'll tax that cow at $1,000. That's a case of equity. Because you're asking for what's known as replenishment. Give me the cow back. Okay? If I'm asking for the value of the cow, saying, now that the cow has become friends with your cows, I don't want it back because I know it won't behave right because it's with your cows. You don't treat your cows the way I treat my cows. You want money, that's law. You want return of it, a justice concept, a fairness concept, that's equity. Now, that became important in England because judges of equity were not lawyers. They were clergy. They said, who better to solve fairness issues than men and women of the cloth? So the clergy were the judges of equity. Lawyers were judges at law. Back about 1800, and this is after the reform of our country, we decide that one person ought to decide all these things together. That it's really kind of silly to go to two separate courts because sometimes those issues come together. You may want to say, John, give me my cow and give me $100 too because I lost the value of milk you invested. And I want Bessie back and a hug. Okay? You shouldn't have to sue twice, right? As a result of that, you're suing in a written vote. We decided in America to merge the courts of law and ethics.
So since about 1800, I think the last state in the United States that did it was about 1830. All states merged their law and ethics. Interestingly enough, the federal courts, which got their start around 1790, always merged. Okay? They never had a separate equity court. Okay? Okay. Most lawsuits, we're talking civil now, not criminal. Most lawsuits involve property. Wealthy people with property, and that was everybody in America because everybody in America had land, because we are a land-rich society. They were the ones who litigated because those were the people who lost their cows. Those were the people who had problems with their crops. Most of the early cases of our case law involve property rights. So the foundation of our case law dealt with property. And when I say the law, the property, or intertwined, because property law doesn't have rights. And the law was created to try to preserve them.
Okay. They're intertwined. They're together. Okay. Around 1840, long time since the Revolution, 7 years, here's a great book for those of you who like to read. It's called The Turning. There's a Yale psychologist and a Harvard historian that got together. He wrote a book that said history repeats itself every 84 years, like clockwork. Because that's the time of four generations, historically. Generation's been about 21 years. They actually say now it's getting longer because people are waiting longer to have kids. But in this book, The Turning, they say after four generations, you come back and correct the where you work. Because if your mom doesn't allow you to watch TV during dinner, your daughter won't let your kids watch TV during dinner because you remember when you wanted to watch TV during dinner, mom will let it. And then it goes on from there. This is the theory. But after 70 years, which is about three-quarters of the way through there, we came back and said, you know, those statute things aren't so bad. Because there are statutes. And our legislators, now state legislatures, are the ones that are doing it. Remember that how a bill becomes a law? Well, guess what? We're creating laws now. So starting in 1840, you started to see more and more statutes coming into play in the law. Interestingly enough, before 1840, guess what most of the statutes were coming out of a state legislature? They were creating corporations. Because before 1840, in order to have a corporation, it took a pact in the state legislature. In England, it took a charter issued by a king. Before we came into power, we said, none of that. We're going to have the state legislatures do it. Around 1840, they shifted from doing those corporations. They did the general corporations laws and started to do other things. They started to pass laws. Now, since that time, you've seen an explosion in statutes. The New York State Legislature, for example, in a two-year legislative session, introduces 10,000 pieces of legislation, and passes about 2,000 of that 10,000. Of that, 1,000 a year become law. So you have 1,000 new statutes every single year just in New York State. That doesn't count what Congress is doing. You've also had a proliferation of lawsuits. You've become a much more litigious society, and as a result, you have more legal cases out there. Somebody slips and falls on your steps, they turn around. Okay, we're going to take a 5-minute break and then come back to a case and we'll get you out of here. Before you leave, come down and take a case, please. Good evening, Mr. President. That's what happens when you sit on the end, but I'm great. How's my buddy? Doing good?
I'm glad
you
put it like that. I'm glad I could get in.
Huh?
I was glad I could get in.
I would have let you do it.
You
had to suffer me before.
I sent you my
great
email. Would you like it?
I got it on email. We're good to go, but I'll take it. If you want to give it to me.
What? You said if you get an A in your class.
I'm sorry,
you said if you get an A in your class, you will get a letter.
I will.
I got one letter.
I know you did. I happen to have been there. I'm happy to give you a letter.
I'm
tell me where to send it, what to do, what to copy, that
I'm just preparing to apply for grad school.
You just tell me where to send it, okay?
I have a junior.
Huh?
I'm a junior.
I know. Can you tell me where to do it? Okay? Okay, I'll take care of you. Now, grow.
My name was not in Tennessee, so it's signed in a little blank space, but I signed up
Friday. Make sure you printed your name there, so I make sure that it's on there.
I think it is.
Okay.
Oh, thank you.
Whoop, thanks. Yep. You just put it in the box.
Thank you.
Who's got the attendance sheet?
Just one?
Sorry, just one. Thank you.
You're welcome, Mayor.
Two and
I didn't want to.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. Not a problem. Thanks. Brewster, New York, a great place. I know Brewster. Thank you. It's online. Just go to BobFarley.org and download it.
Bob Farley. You have your website, so
I do. Make sure it's .org, not .com. Are you going to put that there?
I am.
Oh, good for you.
You're the basketball.
How are we doing? Your basketball?
Yeah.
Good for you, both of you.
We're doing okay. We're going well this year.
I know. So,
another game.
I'm an enormous Bob Ford fan, and it inures to your benefit.
I am, too.
He's a great guy.
Yeah. Better person than
you. He's a great team. Well, can I tell you, it's a great book.
Yes.
Thank you. And I know how hard it is to be a student athlete. You guys having fun?
Yeah.
We're not blowing you to tears, are we, I hope? How are we doing?
Great.
Thank you. Pauling, wonderful place. Is that this guy?
Yeah.
So when did you come from Moscow?
3 years ago.
3 years ago? Boy, your English is beautiful.
Thank you. So how did your daughter like?
She loved it. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
I know the cost. Cost me $8,000 to send her over there for 6 weeks.
Oh.
But she got college credit.
Well, it's a good experience.
Well, it was wonderful. I'm part Russian. My mother. And I love her. We went all over.
You did?
Yeah, we went to a lot of the Republicans in the Christian Moscow. It's a great
place.
I couldn't yet believe how big Moscow is.
Yeah.
It's 16 million people.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's
just
growing.
Now, is your family still there at home?
Yeah.
Do they like you being here or no?
I mean, they're not super happy, but, you know, like my mom.
Hey, your English is awesome. I'm so impressed.
Thank you.
That's
by a brilliant man.
was an even better politician. Okay, come on, Cole. Greg, it's John Adams, one of our most distinguished forefathers. A brilliant lawyer, married to an incredibly talented political wife. You're from Massachusetts. You're a patriot. You believe in the law. Matter of fact, when several innocent people are gunned down in a riot in Boston, known as the Boston Massacre, you defended the British soldiers who were enormously unpopular because you said everyone deserves to run for council. And you actually got them off. Only one was convicted of a less than murder charge because of your talents. And you turned the entire community around saying, don't blame the soldiers, blame England. They're the ones who are the sons. You were a great orator. Everyone thought you were one of the smartest guys in the room. Sadly, John, you let him know about it. Matter of fact, you became the first vice president of the United States. You were everywhere. You turned around and helped write the Declaration of Independence with your best friend. His name was Thomas Jefferson, who's standing there rather tall. He was rather tall. You were about my height, but you are. Okay? John Adams becomes vice president for George Washington. George Washington is the only president who was elected unanimously. He got every vote of the Electoral College. Nobody ever did that. But you were his right hand. He really liked you. George Washington never had any sons. And he went around collecting young men, well, good one, as proteges because he didn't have them. And you were one of the young men that he thought so highly of, personally and professionally. But not everyone agreed with the father of our country as far as how much they liked you. White did. They all respected you. Well, when Congress was thinking about titles, they were coming up with all kinds of elegant titles for the president. Washington wanted to be one of them. They said, call me Mr. President. Okay? They wanted his highness, and his holy uniform, and all the things he did. Then he turned to John Adams. To the reason why he was not the writer of the Declaration of Independence was because even though he was so talented, and even though he helped you, Tom, write it, he realized that he shouldn't be the one writing it, Tom, because he was viewed as rather obnoxious. Apparently his colleagues felt the same way, and when the United States Senate decided what to call you, they passed a resolution that the Vice President should be called his most high-exalted, fat-ass, rounded person. That's not they eventually saw that you were a kind of gentleman, and they removed it because you were a vice president. You were probably the greatest of all of them. And you lived 50 years after the Declaration of Independence and died on the same day as your best friend, on July 4th, 1826. 50 years to the day of the signing of your greatest pact. The Liberty Bell rang out, You became the most important president, I would argue, in the history of the United States. Because even though George Washington had probably one of the hardest jobs, the first trailblazer, he was fit for command. He was a general. He was a colonel. He had a lifetime of command, and he knew how to be an executive. You were never an executive. You were always a legislator. And you had to step into the role and follow George Washington, who was a rock star in his own time. If you want to talk about following somebody's shadow, you had a hard time. But you did it for real. But everybody was a step down from George Washington on his eye. So even though they elected you handily, when you ran against your best friend for president, let up, Tom. Tom and his buddy, Helena, Jimmy, formed the first political party. They called themselves Republican. Today we call them the Democrats. Okay? You were a Federalist. That is the party of George Washington. You ran against each other. You were his political operative, as James Carville would have been. And you won. So you can take a step back. Nice to meet you. Jimmy, go to Congress. You do all that. Back to my side. America had a lot of problems as a young nation. John Adams, giant of the world. But he wasn't all that politically popular. But throughout his entire presidency, our two buddies over here were always sticking at their heels. Now, even though John was really respected, he didn't have a lot of close friends. And he couldn't believe that his best friend outside of his wife in the world would say bad things about him. You were kind of a son of a gun. You said a lot of nasty things about him. And Mr. Carvel, your name is really Mr. James Madison. You started newspapers all over the country for the sole express purpose, which you didn't put your name on, for attacking him. He had the toughest presidency that you could ever imagine. 4 years passed. Your presidency is pretty successful, and the public is kind of warm with you. But you have this onslaught coming from your best friend that you really don't believe that he's saying this thing. And he is. You run against each other again. Jimmy, you're front center. You're in Congress the whole time, packing a crowd. Pretty sad. Anyway. This time, a speaker goes to the House of Representatives. That's how it goes. You're unsuccessful. So you can go down and stand by your friend, John. You get elected. He's number two. Number three, President of the United States. That's the scenario in which this case occurs. Now, you know that Tom is a great guy, but he's an awful executive. He's smart as can be, but you know he's no George Washington. He's been your best friend for 30 years. You grew up together, okay? You knew that when he was governor of the state of Virginia, the British chased him from town to town because he refused to stand up to him. You were kind of an embarrassment. Matter of fact, they couldn't throw you out of office and just wrote the Declaration of Independence, and they figured embarrassing you would embarrass the whole country. So they just put another guy in his governor and said, we know you want to go back to Monticello. We'll leave you with that problem. Okay? Matter of fact, George Washington made you Secretary of State to basically get you out of the country. He was brilliant. But kind of like a dog in a trash can. He couldn't stay out of trouble. Adams knows this. You have an idea of Mitty. He's kind of like the forefather version of New Jersey. Every idea is great except every tenth one. And then it's so wacky that you don't know what happens. He is brilliant. Adams knows all this and fears for his country. So the day he gets elected, you get to work. Now that, under our original Constitution, the president does not take office until March. So he's got a long period of time between the election and the oath of office. Okay? You're not a bad guy. You're just an idea of it. And you're an enabler. Go stand over there. Please. Please. Yep. Okay, come on forward, gentlemen. John is an amazing guy, John Marshall. His parents raised him, because we're about the same family in Virginia, to be a lawyer. You're one of those kids, they hand you Blackstone, remember that, Blackstone Prizes, when you're a baby. Here it is, learning. You start reading the law as a kid. Everything you think about is legal. You're an amazing mind. Jay? Well, this is the author of the Constitution. He not only argues for the Constitutional Convention, the Philadelphia, but you also do another thing. You write every word of it, get it passed, and then go out and write the Federalist Papers to convince everybody it needs to be ratified. One of the key states for ratification, because ratification is not for a long conclusion. We think it is in this day and age, it wasn't. One of the key states was Virginia. And the guy who took you out as governor, Patrick Henry, giving liberty or giving death, wanted ratification to go under. He wanted it to fail. He's the leading power in Virginia. He doesn't want a constitution. Why? Virginia's so big, it can be a country on its own, they don't want it. You lead the war fight in the Virginia Convention. You not only get it passed in Philadelphia, but you bring it to the most important state for ratification. Virginia's the biggest state by far, and whether or not it will ratify will determine whether it will be ratified by the other states as well. You have a young, talented lawyer who's going to be your buddy in the fight. John? A young guy by the name of John Marshall. You're impressed. You kind of have the same leg difference, too. John Marshall helps lead the floor fight with you in Virginia. And you ratify by a handful of votes because of his legal acumen. You're a very gifted, brilliant lawyer, a strategist, a good legislator. It's time to come to sports. John Marshall is a commanding orator, which helps you carry the name. You become what? Even though he's a Federalist, you're a Republican. Gotcha. You go straight. You're gay. John Marshall, his friends with Adams. He becomes the Secretary of State at the end of the term. Now, how did he become President of the United States in the early part of our history? The road to the presidency goes through the Secretary of State. It's the number one political appointment. It's the person who deals with foreign countries. It's the one who deals with a lot of the administrative side of government with the executive. Five Secretaries of State become the president in the first United Presidents. You have your eye on the White House. Okay? You what? And by the way, you were Secretary of State under Washington. That's why you're president now. Okay? You realize this is the way to do it. But, well, you're right. He has such confidence in you that he appoints you Secretary of State. But you know your term is coming to an end. And what office can you put your most trusted guy in that won't go away? What office in the federal government has a lifetime appointment? Supreme Court of the United States. John Jay is becoming rather elderly. He's a senior guy. You want to be Chief Justice. So he appoints you Chief Justice. You serve in a dual capacity until the end of his term. You serve as Chief Justice, and you confirm in March, right as he's leaving office, because Congress took that long to get something to do. So the Federalist Congress confirms you. If you serve as Secretary of State, you will serve. You're now Chief Justice. Why don't you go stand there and get the deal box? Where did Tim go? You're not going away. You're going away. Okay. Well, you stay there. Thomas Jefferson comes to power. And he sees his old friend do everything he can to dismantle the administration that he wants to put in place. Not only did John Adams appoint John Marshall, but he had all these court acts passed in Congress, and he appointed literally hundreds of judges. John, as Secretary of State, you were the guy who literally went out and handed these judgeships to you. You would turn around and say, here's your certificate of appointment. That's where it is. You're now a judge. You were riding as fast as you can because there's hundreds of them. You were going ballistic. You take the old office and say, this has got to stop. You tell your Secretary of State, no more. Any of them that aren't delivered are done. Okay? Okay. You can go stand. Go stand. John? Not only are you the Chief Judge, who today would most certainly have to recuse himself, but you're also an instrumental player in this case. Judge Barber. Judge Barber, he's not one of those judges. But poor John has so many to deliver, he never got a chance to give you yours. It was signed by President Adams, but he never delivered it. And when Jefferson comes into office, he says, Jim, don't deliver them. You got enough of these crazy federalists, you don't want to do it. Okay? they're going to take over the judiciary program and so on. What do you do? You look at water. You want to touch it, so what do you do to get it? Very good. Judge Barbary sues. And who do you sue? Madison. Why? Madison is the new Secretary of State. You sue in equity, okay, to have James Madison deliver your commission to you so you can become that judge. Without that piece of paper, you don't get the key. Okay? President Thomas Jefferson has said, go deliver it. Follow what he said. So you bring it back. Okay. You can sit down. You can sit down. Stand down here and think the difference. Now, John Marshall, brilliant man of the age, is up to this case to hear. He was the guy who never delivered the commission. But nobody brings that up. Why do you think that is? No, why do you think that who would bring that up? You would bring that up. No, they wouldn't go. They don't want him to sign in this case. He was a guy that shouldn't deliver commissions. Huh? Yeah, but they don't know. Okay? Why don't before this decision is decided, doesn't Jefferson and Madison complain that he shouldn't rule on
this?
No, because it was a case of original jurisdiction. They brought it originally in the Supreme Court. Because it was assumed, a federal officer formed it, and they said it had original jurisdiction. Why don't they think he complained? No. No, right, that's just the opposite. You don't want a federalist society, right? Because it's going to go against you. You're worried that he's out of stock. Why did you want him to sign that? You're sure as shooting when he's going to decide to give her a judgeship. He's going to order you to give all those judges away. Why don't you complain about it? No.
You're the president, and he decided against you.
Well, just touch your buddies. You owe him. He stepped up for you and delivered the votes at the Constitutional Convention for ratification in Virginia. You never forgot that. And you don't want to embarrass him. You know he's a good gift of legal mind, and you're hoping in the thinking that even if he goes against him, you're just going to ignore him. You're hoping he doesn't win. Okay. You also know that you're into this up to your ears. How do you get out of this, saving your reputation, your new role as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and the Federalist way of life? If you believe it, you have to craft a very difficult decision. Why do I illustrate this? Because decisions are not just law, they're also politics. There's a lot of swirl going on here. What does John Marshall decide? First, as a good federalist, he says you deserve your judgeship. We ought to give it to you. By the way, he doesn't say, I ought to give it to you. He leaves that small part out. But he says you should have received it. You earned it. It was rightfully boasted. You ought to have it. But he also says something else. says the law that you have by which you're suing, which is judiciary acts, are unconstitutional. That this case should not be before this court. Now, before this time, of course, it wasn't a lot of time. I mean, this is only 1803. Okay? This is decided. Remember, the United States doesn't even get voting until 1787. Okay? 1788 is the first act. How then was constitutionality covered? Mostly by presidential veto. George Washington vetoed a few items saying this is unconstitutional. James Madison stood up frequently as a congressman in the House of Representatives saying, I'm not going to pass this because it's unconstitutional. It was viewed as every branch's responsibility to determine constitutionality. Guess what? You didn't want to be left out from that parade. So you said, how can I make this happen? How can I advance federalist principles? How can I expand the power of the court to make everybody happy? Well, I tell you, you deserve your judgeship, but you're not going to get it. Why? Because we didn't have jurisdiction. Why didn't we have jurisdiction? Because it's unconstitutional.
Why is it unconstitutional? Because we follow the law of the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says it should. Now, who's going to complain about that? You going to complain about it? No, because you got the result you want. She didn't get a judge yet. You're not going to complain about it, about me. I don't care how we got there, it got there. You going to complain about it? Not at all, because your federalist courts are all in power. You going to complain about it? You just made the Supreme Court the arbiter of everything constitutional. You complain about it a little bit because you've shown that legislative mindset. But not too much, because A, he's your buddy, and B, now you don't have to deliver the commission, so you're out. Now, you look at this decision, there's a lot in it. A lot of legal reasoning. But at the end of the day, it's crafted based on the facts and circumstances that were before. If he had upheld that, he had said, you get your judgeship and ordered through mandamus you to deliver it, what could he have done if you had said no? Nothing. It's up, and he knows, Jefferson, you're a free-spirited guy, you tell him to go pound salt. So he knew if he gave your judgeship in there and ordered them to do it, it would still never happen and you'd create a constitutional crisis. Because the federal court would order the executive to do it and you didn't do it. Matter of fact, that happened later in the United States history. Famous case of Jackson. No. It's a famous case with Andrew Jackson, where he turned around and said, Chief Justice Orderer, let him enforce it. That separation happened. He didn't want that to happen. The Supreme Court was brand new. And the concept of judicial review, the Supreme Court having the ability to toss out a law made by Congress, came out of this case, but it was all factual. It was a right that we now have. And you did it, John. See you next week.